Good afternoon. You're very welcome to today's edition of Saturday with Clare Byrne. On today's programme, it's a weekend of last-minute budget negotiations. There may be a bit more in the pot, but it'll be impossible to keep everyone happy. We'll hear who's sticking the boot in for more as the clock ticks down to budget day. Would you share a kitchen and a living room as per Owen Murphy's latest idea to alleviate the housing crisis? We'll talk about that and lots more with our panel very shortly. But first, it's time for the news now with Christopher McKevitt. Thank you very much, Christopher. This is Saturday with Clare Byrne. You're very welcome to the programme. And I'm going to introduce our panel to you now with Fergus O'Dowd, Fine Gael TD, Jim O'Callaghan, Fianna Fáil TD and Justice Spokesperson, Richard Boyd Barrett, Solidarity People Before Profit TD, and Colin McCarthy, Economist. Sinead O'Carroll, News Editor of the Journal.ie, will be joining us in just a moment. But we're going to start with the budget. What's going on, Jim? Still happening over the weekend?
Yeah. Michael McGrath and Derek O'Leary are still in negotiations with the government. The government obviously being represented by the Minister for Finance, Pascal Donoghue. Those talks have been going on for a period of time now. What we're trying to do in those talks is to ensure that the policy priorities that we got put into the confidence and supply agreement are implemented in this budget.
So what's outstanding at this stage?
Well, I'm not going to go into the specifics of it, but if you look...
That's why you're here.
Well, even if I knew the specifics, I don't think I could go into it. But like Michael McGrath and Dara, you know, we've great faith in them to negotiate on our behalf. But what we're trying to get achieved, it's not a great secret, is look at the confidence and supply agreement. That's what we want to see in this budget. We got a lot of it in the last budget. The most important thing we achieved in the confidence and supply, as was reflected in the budget last year, is that we got a shift in the Fine Gael mentality so that there's a 2-to-1 split in favour of services over tax cuts. We got that last year. We want it again this year. We managed to get some small reductions for USE payers at the lower middle earners. We're hoping to get that again. We'd like to see mortgage interest relief retained beyond December 2017. We'd like to see an increase in the state pension. These are the issues that we have in the confidence and supply agreement. But I recognise, and Fianna Fáil recognises, there's a limited amount of money here.
Well, there's very little. There was very little until this morning, but I see from the front of the Irish Times that there may be a billion, whereas previously we were talking about 300 million.
Yeah, the fiscal space, we're all told, was 1.2 million. But when you take into account what's already been committed, there's around 300 million there. But obviously, it's a matter for the government.
So is there a billion or 300? What do you know?
Well, I don't know. But it's obviously a matter for the government. If the government want to engage in revenue raising measures, obviously the government aren't simply restricted to what's in the confidence and supply agreement. Like, we aren't in government. It's not our budget. All we can try to do is to have an impact on the budget by trying to get some of our policies implemented. But we don't write the whole thing.
Okay. Fergus, have you heard about this extra money?
Well, I read the same stories yourself, but obviously the cabinet members, and indeed particularly the Taoiseach and the Minister of Finance, are privy to the most secret parts of the budget. We'll all know next Tuesday. But what we do know now is that obviously we want the supply agreement between Fianna Fáil and ourselves to continue. Clearly, we're listening to everything they're saying and to everybody else as well. The key message for Fine Gael is that for the average worker on the average industrial wage, that they will not be paying the highest rate of tax, which they presently do.
Is it frustrating for you because you have Fianna Fáil there with their confidence and supply arrangement negotiating this weekend, the Independent Alliance with their list of things? I mean, Fine Gael people like yourself might be back of the queue here.
No, not at all, because I think the key point is, in our mind, is the tax that people pay unfairly on the average industrial wage. People, low-income earners and average earners, paid the higher rate of tax at 33,800. The average wage is higher than that. So we need to encourage more people to work.
But to keep the government together, you have to give things to the Independent Alliance. You have to give things to Fianna Fáil. So they're looking for social welfare increases.
Well, we would have, obviously, we'd be on the same page as most people in terms of equality and fairness in our society, looking after people who are sick, who are disabled, looking after old age pensioners, dealing with the housing crisis. These are all agenda items for all of us. And this government is absolutely committed to a public of opportunity and fairness and building greater equality into our tax system and into our society.
Richard Boyd Barrett, I'm tempted to say that Fergus from Fine Gael wants the same things as you do.
Well, I do think it's interesting, actually, even the leaks today, how some of the things that we've been talking about, the left have been talking about the last few years, for example, the huge loopholes in corporate tax, giveaways, really, to the big corporations, that there's now talk of maybe tightening up in some of these areas and getting extra revenue. And that's the point that we've been trying to make around this budget debate, that beyond the miserable crumbs of the fiscal space and how we divide up this very small amount of money between tax breaks for workers and public services, it's just not enough, first of all, to deal with the crisis we have in housing, in health, in education.
But I don't think anybody would argue with that. It's just not enough.
But the point we have made, and I think we've seen some evidence that we were right in the leaks today, is that in fact there is a lot of extra money if there's a political will to go after it, particularly in the area of what are called tax expenditures, tax reliefs, allowances and deductions, billions of them, that are given every year to the corporate sector, which reduce down their effective corporate tax rate to negligible levels. I mean, we saw, what, 300 million going in R&D tax credits? Or, no, sorry, more. It's up to 600 million now. It's massive. Now, that is money.
Would you have to welcome this today, if this is right in the Irish Times, that there will be more revenue raised from stamp duty on commercial property?
Yeah, that was in our budget.
That's what you're looking for.
Absolutely.
So they're listening. So you're having an impact. So you're pleased.
We are having an impact. But our point is we need to be much more ambitious. And at the moment, even with the increased expenditure they're talking about, it's not enough to deal with the housing crisis. I mean, we need to double at least the output of council housing over the next period to have any chance of dealing with what is a catastrophe. And if you look at the health service, 600,000 people on waiting lists. The doctors are saying today, if you look at the Examiner, that 350 people are going to die on trolleys. And this is because we have slaughtered hospital beds. We haven't got enough nurses in the health service.
Waiting lists, I accept absolutely that anybody on a trolley in the hospital is unacceptable. But the facts are, and I'm quoting the Irish Nursing Organisation website today, that the number of people on trolleys are actually 6% lower for July of this year compared to July of last year. And I accept that some hospitals significantly
on Wednesday they were higher for that day than at any other time since records
began. Yes, but I'm quoting their analysis, and that's their analysis, month-to-month analysis. You can do it yourself on Twitter.
But it's not a good story. No, but
it is an improving story. My hospital, the Lourdes Hospital in Drogheda County, the regional hospital, had two people on waiting list yesterday. Now, that's too many.
On trolleys?
On trolleys, waiting in the hospital. So the facts are that some hospitals are making significant improvements. Others aren't. We're not avoiding the problem. It has to be dealt with, and significant progress has been made. The other point is about balancing the budget. Richard is right about all the nice things we'd all like to do. The fact is, this is the first time in 10 years that you have income equals expenditure in our budget. So you cannot put new debt on our new families.
We're not proposing to put new debt. It's very important to say, Fergus.
But the point is that we have to balance our books. And I think that we've spent, of the 58 billion we spent last year,
he's saying you have choices.
45 billion went on social welfare, health and education.
And that's an important point that Richard's making, that he's not talking about borrowing. He's talking about finding revenue streams, places where you've overlooked tax breaks that you've given to corporations, perhaps, that you could pull back in more cash, not borrow more.
Well, the point is we need more FDI investment. I want to attract in businesses into my constituency and into yours and into Richard's. We have to compete in the world market. We have hugely skilled professionals wanting to come in here. We have to make it their income that they earn here must be adequate.
Can I make an important point on this, Fergus? A huge amount of our sort of economic output and these tax breaks going to them are going to about 10-20 big multinationals. That makes us very vulnerable. That is not a sustainable economic model over the long term. Now, I would say it is far better that 600 million goes to our universities rather than to a small number of corporations, because that will be sustainable investment in research and development that have a real economic benefit
for our economy. The people who work in those companies, what do you think they're thinking when they hear you say that?
If you look at the level of profits these companies are making, they're not going to run out unless we, you know, put the headline rate up well in excess of what's happening in the rest of Europe. We're so far below the rest of Europe, we could easily get extra revenue from these companies without scaring them out of the country. But when you look at what's happening in the United States, with them talking about reducing their corporate tax rate, with the race to the bottom in corporation tax generally across the world, this is a dangerous economic model to have our economy so dependent
on these
companies.
I want to bring you in here, and I want to come back to the front page of the Irish Times today. We have a billion to spend. Isn't it great news? I knew you'd be delighted that we'd found this money down the back of the sofa.
Yeah, well, first of all, on the Irish Times story, either it's true, in which case there will have to be a Garda investigation, because leaking budget secrets, including proposed tax changes, is an offence under the Official Secrets Act. So I hope it's an appointed rather than an elected official, Fergus, that leaked this.
Maybe it's the editor making up a story.
That leaked this stuff. It's possible that the Irish Times... It's possible the Irish Times just made it up. We'll know on Tuesday.
I'm sure they didn't before they phone in. Go ahead,
The whole budget pantomime is out of date now. It's just an annual farce. Last year's budget contained a series of very small measures on the tax side and very small measures on the expenditure side. It cannot be any other way. We're up to our tonsils in debt, as everybody knows. The economy's recovered pretty well, better than I'd expected, and the budget is nearly back in some kind of balance, but we still have all the debts that arose through the downturn. And the annual budget will be like this for some years. It will be a small deal.
I thought it was going to become a big deal in 1920 and 21. Did we not hear that in the last couple of weeks?
Do you believe everything you hear from
these? Well, I don't, but I mean, we can all live in hope.
In the sky.
Yeah. The Irish government is going to have to do what it did during the 1990s. The last time we got into an enormous flipping hole at the end of the 80s, the debt got excessive, it wasn't sustainable, and there was a decade of non-event budgets, of more or less balanced budgets. And this has been a challenge for the media because they have to wind up the excitement from late August onwards, and they have to fill the papers every day with inspired speculation about will tax go up by a penny or a penny halfpenny, and will there be a shilling extra for social welfare recipients, and is there going to be a split in the government? That's always a good one. But the whole thing is kind of a cod. Last year, I'd say there's quite a few listeners can't remember the specific items that were in last year's budget.
Not there wasn't a whole lot in it anyway.
Indeed.
Well, what do you think when you hear Fianna Fáil arguing for the fiver, which looks like it's going to happen, if not just for pensioners, but across the board now, if you believe what's in the papers today?
Yeah, if I was an opposition politician, I would be arguing for lower taxes and higher expenditure.
And if you're a government politician?
That's different. Then you have to run the country. There's something quite significant that's going to arise in the next month or 6 weeks, and it's which I think will be more significant than the budget, and that is a new capital programme. And that has to be a five-year or six-year or whatever time horizon. And one of the things that happened in 2009, 10, 11, 12 was a very sharp reduction in government capital spending. The media didn't notice, of course, because the media got hugely excited about much smaller cuts in current spending and the opposition. But there was a really big cutback in the capital budget. Now, arguably, it was too big at the end of the bubble anyway. But it's now time to look carefully at whatever bottlenecks are emerging, and we all know about public housing, for social housing, for example. But there are lots of others. But there is a limit to what the government can do, even on a 4 or 5 year period time horizon. And it's really important that when the capital plan comes out, every single project is costed properly. There is honest upfront cost-benefit studies on any major commitments.
And that contrasts with?
What we've done for the last 40 years, which is dream up something that sounds exciting. But the Taoiseach...
On budget day.
But, sorry, this is in the capital program.
Yeah, you're saying that the capital projects are properly costed. Is that what you're saying, as opposed to...
There's a 10-year plan coming up.
Sorry.
It'll be announced for December. That's what I'm
talking about. Not just properly cost, but properly evaluated.
Right.
Honest comparisons between this project and that project on the basis that you can't do them all. Now, in the very recent past, both of the candidates for the Fine Gael leadership, both Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney, announced high-speed railway lines in a country that barely has enough rail traffic to justify a bus route. Extraordinary stuff. So it's really important that we
give up. That was in the context of the leadership campaign. Should we don't mind any of those things?
No, no. One of the Taoiseach announced a high-speed railway line to Belfast.
Oh, I think he really meant upgrading the railway line.
Well, why didn't he say that?
Well, I didn't write his speech, but it is a high-speed railway line already. They have significant improvements continue to be made and will be made. It's a huge growth area between Dublin and Belfast.
No, it's between Dublin and Drogheda and Dundalk.
No, but it's an actual fact.
Anyway, what's your point about that, Colin? You say it's a waste of time.
Cross-border investment
really?
Projects.
Okay. Yeah.
That was part of the...
The number of passengers end-to-end on Dublin-Belfast is tiny. It's only about a quarter or a fifth of the end-to-end passengers on Dublin-Cork. It's 183,000.
Okay. Can I just say...
I read your figures.
Colin has identified a very important point. I'm about to agree with you, if you let me speak.
Yeah.
He's identified a very important point. Where we are in terms of capital investment is where we were back in 2001. The failing of this government is their failure to recognise the requirement that we need greater, longer thought out capital investment. Like, the two big issues facing our society are housing and health, and third level, if you add that in as well. And we haven't had any vision from this government as to how they're going to solve the housing crisis.
When people saw the Irish Times story this morning, the cynical version of your brain will look and go, God, where did they find this money? And then you think, oh, actually, they're doing something commercial, as Richard was saying.
Yeah.
You know, it's things that have been called for from the left. Everyone's getting a fiver, which is a bit unfocused, a bit untargeted, a bit ineffectual for a lot of people. And that's because we're hearing Fianna Fáil has to be kept happy. Various people in the Independent Alliance have to be kept happy. Whereas on the other hand, wouldn't it be a lot better if there was more focus spending on what Colm is saying, on what you're saying about housing? But this is a Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael agreement that we're reading here. There are issues
in terms of current expenditure, which is what you're talking about there, Sinead. And I don't apologise for the fact that Fianna Fáil is looking to have the old age pension increased, is looking to have carers and disability allowances increased. But separate from that, we have to look at the whole issue of capital investment, capital infrastructure. And we're going to have to consider, as we said yesterday in the document we published, we're going to have to consider alternative funding mechanisms in order to ensure that we can try and get greater infrastructural development in issues such as health, housing, because it's failing at present and we've a serious deficiency.
One of the reasons it failed is because of the way that the Fianna Fáil government dealt with the strategic development plans right around the country. So what our government is talking about now is a 10-year strategic investment plan, which will be announced by December. The consultation progress is in place. And Colm, you're absolutely right. Every item on it must be properly costed and transparently on the table. The other point is that the joined-up thinking, which was not there when Fianna Fáil were on power, will be there now under this proposed strategic planning for right around the country.
Why wasn't it there for the past 6 years?
Well, because your plan was still there.
But you're in government for 6 years.
No, but I'm just saying is that the developments that took place under the planning framework that was there is ending now.
Don't fight with them, Fergus, because you need them on Tuesday to get this budget through.
It's not fighting. It's about the truth and about the facts. The facts are there will be and there is a significant programme in place or coming into place in relation to the key issues for Fianna Fáil and what Colm is saying. We want proper development, planned, phased, structured development. We haven't had that, absolutely. We will have it now. But I would welcome rail investment in Drogheda, bringing the Dart to Drogheda and Dundalk. Issues like that are very important. It's about bringing benefits to the rural and other parts of our country. Okay. The last point, Minister Darcy and the payments corridor on the Belfast Dublin corridor, like there's a huge investment hopefully coming in bringing businesses to towns like Drogheda and Dundalk and other places in the country in relation to investing in new ideas and getting new industry, new business into our towns and our villages, which we don't have at the moment.
Richard Boyd Barrett.
Well, I want to argue we need to learn the lessons of the last 10 or 15 years, right? Under Fianna Fáil, our tax revenues were dependent essentially on an unsustainable property speculation bubble. Then we've gone to the other extreme with Fine Gael, with when those revenues collapse, there's vicious austerity imposed on people who weren't responsible for that. And that means our infrastructure spending has collapsed, our capital investment, public capital investment collapsed, and of course, very harsh austerity imposed on other people. All along, there was an alternative. And it's the thing that's never, never talked about. And that is that profits are going through the roof. Profits pre-tax profits in the last 10 years, people don't know this, have doubled from 70 billion to 149 billion. Economic household wealth in this country has jumped by 57%. And that's mostly concentrated, as the CSO confirmed in their study a couple of years ago, that is mostly concentrated in the hands of the richest 10% of the population. So Ireland is fantastically wealthy, but all the money is concentrated in the hands of a few big corporations and a few very, very wealthy people. If those billions were released and put into capital investment, we could deal with the crisis in housing, in health, in education, in the water infrastructure, all of which have been starved. And indeed, we could give a break to workers. Because the other very important point to say is, why did we have a debt problem? We have a debt problem because the real value of wages have been cut by about 20% over the last 25 years. So workers, even if they have relatively decent jobs, can't afford to put a roof over their head. In the 1970s, if you were a teacher or a nurse or whatever, you could get a mortgage. Now you can't even get a mortgage.
That's true.
Okay, Colin McCarthy, do you want to come back in here? Because I saw your facial reactions to some of what we've heard in the last 5 minutes, and I want to explore them a bit more.
Could you email me, Richard, with the figures that show that real wages have fallen over 25 years?
Wage share, yeah. I will absolutely. Wage share.
But it was
as a proportion of national income has dropped 20%, Colin.
Yeah, but that's not what you said.
That is exactly what I said.
You said real wages have dropped.
The real value of them. The real value of them.
But that's not the same thing as wage share and national income.
It is absolutely the same. Colin. Are you disputing the point, Colin?
Somebody who was a
white-collar worker in the 70s or 80s who had a job, could get a mortgage, and now the same worker can't afford to put a roof over their head.
That's the real value
of their wages.
Okay, if you attach zero significance to the precision of language, that's your choice. Can I come back to something that
no,
Jim
said? No, I just don't want to obscure people with jargon.
Are you finished? I want to come back to something that Jim said that concerns me. People seem to think that the constraint on the government in diverting resources into the capital programme is entirely financial. And he mentioned this idea of off-balance sheet manoeuvres to borrow money that's not on the Exchequer balance sheet through, I presume, public-private partnerships or devices like that. There's two points that need to be understood about that. The first is that just because you can hide a debt off balance sheet doesn't mean it's not your debt.
You're still borrowing the money, right?
You're still borrowing the money and it still has to be serviced and repaid. And some of these private finance initiatives, as they call them in the UK, they call them PPPs here, have been shown to have been costly to the Exchequer in the long run because of the way in which the financial deals are done. So I'm a little bit nervous about off-balance sheet stunts. Second, the constraint on expanding the construction industry in a hurry here is the size and capacity of the construction industry. There's already construction companies are complaining about a lack of skilled labour.
They can't get the staff and then they can't get somewhere for them to stay.
So we're not.
That's why you need increased wages.
We're not, thankfully, in the situation that we were in 4 or 5 years ago when 14 and 15% of the workforce were out of work. The unemployment rate is now down to 6. It may fall a bit further, and we are beginning to hit up against constraints in the supply of real resources. That's got nothing to do with money. What that means is that if you want to get a bunch of guys to go off and build social housing or build roads or whatever it is, then they're going to have to stop building something else. And that's a real constraint,
It's capacity.
It is not a financial constraint.
It is, absolutely. It's about getting people back who have emigrated with the skills shortages. It's providing places for them. I can make the point here on housing. Like, the government is going to spend £5.4 billion on housing by 2020. So there is significant starts in every constituency in the country. There are more houses starting, but we need to build on state lands. We need to have fixed price housing, if we can, to offer by the state tenders for contractors to come in. We need to radically alter what we're doing. I think that Minister Owen Murphy proposing change the planning regulations in terms of centre city heights of buildings, in terms of transport corridor heights
and so on. Lorcan Sir was saying that if you build these high rise apartments, it actually costs a lot of money to go up, and that those housing units will be available to wealthy people. people because they'll be expensive.
Absolutely.
Well, I think they're not going to be cheap.
Well, the key point is that that is a key point, but it is much cheaper to build up than to build out because you're using on 1 acre of ground, you can build, I don't know how many houses but like a house. But come here, where are the people going to live? Is it not cheaper to build 6 apartments in a block than to build 6 separate houses on land that costs a fortune?
First of all, can I say, I both agree and disagree with Colm, right? I disagree. There is potentially a capacity problem, but if we increased wages and if we reduced the cost of accommodation, we could get a lot of the construction workers back from other countries. And in that sense, I agree with Fergal. Also, if we invest in third level in apprenticeships, we can increase the supply,
and
right?
Building up, what's your view on building up?
No, I don't believe, I mean, some increases in height, but I don't think that's the key, because that's more about incentivizing the private for property sector to make money. That's what they're looking to do. And it doesn't guarantee that those units will actually be affordable by the people who need them.
And what did you think of the communal living idea that Owen Murphy thought it was intriguing? So you'd have your ensuite bedroom, which you'd be sharing your living space.
Can I just make this point, right? And this is where I do agree with Colm about, what do you choose to build, right? In our area, and this is true in a lot of parts of Dublin where the demand is greatest for housing, there's going to be 8,000 houses, a new town built in Cherrywood, the same as happening out in the Clondalkin area. That could solve the housing crisis in our area, but currently it won't, because the vast majority of that housing is going to be sold at market prices, which are completely unaffordable. Mm. The proportion of that construction that is social and affordable has to be dramatically increased. But under Fine Gael, the reliance is completely on the private sector.
Minister Murphy's announcement, I hear so many announcements from the Department of Housing. That actually, yesterday, I went to the Department of Housing website. They're a very effective website where you can filter down the press releases. I looked to see how many press releases on housing there have been from the department since February 2011. The answer is 210. We have about over 30 a year, works out at around 2, maybe 3 a month. All we get from this government is announcements and statements as to how, or some new gimmick they think is going to resolve the housing crisis. What is consistent about the government is that they have failed to recognise that they have an obligation in terms of building social housing. They've only built 4,000 social houses since
they came to government. Too many
we built a lot of houses, and we were criticised for building too many houses. One thing we were good at is building houses. We built a lot of social housing. Well. But in terms of what the priority of this government
Property developers to build social housing.
I don't care who builds them, provided they're built.
People
who are living in housing don't care who builds them, as long as they have a house over their head.
Developers were allowed to buy their way out of that as well.
And that's one of the problems now when we hear of the various initiatives coming and the ideas. A lot of them puts the developer as king again, which is absolutely what we don't need. What we do need is a variety of options on a variety of houses. I think the amount of initiatives, and I agree with Jim on this, the amount of initiatives that have come from the government is like a government trying to do absolutely everything but build a house. Owen Murphy's one yesterday. I think a lot of people maybe of a certain age will think, oh God, that's another gimmick.
But the communal living.
But we need more, especially in built up urban areas, we need more variety, more affordability and
more choice
for what we're doing. I think for something in the communal living, I talked to somebody yesterday who lived in one in London, and she was saying it was an excellent option for her. It was very short term and it is expensive. It's not an affordable, you're not talking about hostel living or any kind of an emergency accommodation. You're talking £800 a month in London, so it's comparable to what you're paying in Dublin now, but it means you're not committing to a lease. So there's lots of ways it would be useful if you're just finished college and you're not sure of your income yet. You're in the middle of finding one apartment and moving to another.
You share the kitchen, you share the living room and you have your own ensuite bedroom.
And you've no commitment to a lease or anything like that. Some people cleans up.
There's a very good article in The Guardian about that about 2 weeks ago. It's an article on build to rent in London, which is very effective, but it was for professionals, and I acknowledge the difference in emphasis there could be on that, but it does work and it works extremely well.
But it has to work hand in hand with lots of other things.
But if you're a developer now, you're looking at this and you go, I mightn't have to provide a car park. I might be able to build up on the land, so I get more value out of the little bit of land that I own. Communal living reduces the amount of services that I have to put in there. This is all this is all bonus for the developer.
No, it isn't really, because you see, when you're talking about car parking, you're talking about sustainable living. You're talking about if you're building in centre of cities and on major transport corridors, if you're within 1 kilometre of a public transport option, well, then why do you need a car space if your public transport is there for you?
But what?
Can I just finish point? Like, if you go to other cities in the world, go to places like San Francisco, you won't get planning permission in San Francisco if you provide any car parking at all. It's all about sustainable transport options. So that's what it's about. And the other point I want to make, and I want to make this firmly, is that the question of government and social housing, like, there's 19,000 families got social housing options that they were satisfied with last year. There'll be 21,000 this year.
Okay.
We are building, we will be building,
no,
I just want to make this point,
yeah, really
clear,
quickly,
please.
You said they were
25,000 social housing per year.
15,000 of them are in HAPS tenancies.
But hold on,
happy.
I can answer that as well, because here's the fact. The biggest, most damning fact of all for everybody out there is that 6,400 houses were offered by NAMA to county councils up and down the country for families on the housing list, and it took 2,500 of them.
Okay, we'll
so
leave
you
that
had
there.
Enough in Dublin to house every single family, and it's councils.
My area in the council went to NAMA and was refused.
Taking a break, back with more after this.
That's true.
We've Fergus O'Dowd with us today from Fine Gael, Jim O'Callaghan, Fianna Fáil, Richard Boyd Barrett from Solidarity PBP, Colin McCarthy,
for-profit, we like to call it.
And Sinead O'Carroll, news editor of the Journal.ie. No abbreviations for Richard Boyd Barrett. Won't even call you RBB then, won't get out that either. I don't know if you saw Boris Johnson sent out this WhatsApp message to his Tory party colleagues this morning, and he said, "Folks, I'm away, but just read this. We've just had an election and people are fed up with all this malarkey. Get behind the PM, circle the wagons, turn the fire on Corbyn, talk about nothing else except our great policies." And then in reference to her speech said, "People I've spoken to thought her speech was good and anyone can have a cold." Does anyone know what this man is at?
Yeah. Part of the reason why Britain is in such a difficult political and economic position is because of the dire quality of the English politicians that have existed since 2010, between 2010 and 2017. When you look at Cameron, when you look at Osborne, when you look at Gove, when you look at Johnson, these are people who view politics as sort of a vanity project where they're the main players in it and it's all about themselves. That's part of the reason Britain is in such a difficult position. Like, if you look at the talented leaders in Britain today, you have to go north of the border. That's the border with Scotland. You look to see Nicola Sturgeon or Ruth Davidson. The rest of them are dismal. And unfortunately, Theresa May...
Is she a goner?
I would have thought she's a goner. She's, in a way, she's partly responsible for her own difficulties. If you look at how she operated during the referendum campaign, she was a Remainer, but she decided to be a quiet Remainer. She didn't come out really in canvas for Remain. She was being too opportunistic. She thought that the election was going to be... defeated, that Brexit wouldn't happen, and then the Tory party would want to elect a Brexiteer as its next leader, or somebody who was a soft Remainer. So she had calculated this, and now it's coming back to haunt her. And like, they really have no idea where they're going politically in terms of their negotiations with Brexit. But part of the problem rests with the quality of the politicians. And in fairness, like, the significant political figure in Britain from the 21st century to date has been Blair, but unfortunately people don't listen to him because of Iraq.
Jeremy Corbyn is apparently, Richard, having talks with the EU, and those talks have ramped up now. So obviously there is a sense that perhaps another election is coming down the tracks.
It certainly looks that way. But I just want to again try and change the narrative here. The background to all the crisis of the British political establishment is 25 years of Thatcherism, which devastated everywhere except London, basically. The north of England, Wales, the Midlands, absolutely slaughtered, right? And the anger against that has been directed in a very cynical, frankly racist way by UKIP and the Tory right, who are just obnoxious. People like Johnson, absolutely obnoxious, opportunist, and so on. And Labour were pathetic. They did not defend their core working class constituency under Blair. It's not just the Iraq war and that disaster. That was Labour under Blair moved so far to the right, they completely alienated their own working class base. So there's an existential political crisis. But the one bright spark on the horizon is Jeremy Corbyn. And Corbyn is not just an isolated phenomenon to Britain. We've seen it in the United States with Bernie Sanders. We've seen it with Mélenchon in France, where a reaction against a failed political establishment and years of austerity is now beginning to articulate itself in
a more
progressive left direction.
Are we sure where Jeremy Corbyn stands when it comes to Brexit? I mean, do we know what we would get?
Jeremy Corbyn is critical from a left perspective of the European Union, and rightly so. But he's absolutely anti-racist. He doesn't buy into any of this rotten xenophobia of the UKIPs and of the Tory right. But he is... he's critical from a progressive left point of view of the European Union.
Colin,
and God, isn't that justified given what they did to this country, their silence over Catalonia at the moment, what they did to Greece?
But unfortunately, that's not the debate that led to Brexit. That's not the debate that led to the referendum. So if you try and spin that narrative onto Brexit, that's not the debate that was had there. The debate was inherently xenophobic and it was stoking prejudice around that. And I think the background is right. About the economy, but they stoke prejudice to make it about obscurely about immigration.
To scapegoat people, as is happening all across Europe.
Colin, you wanted to come in on the Corbyn question. Go ahead.
Yeah, Corbyn's views and the views of the Labour Party's leadership and the National Executive were clearly portrayed at their own conference the previous week, the week previous to Theresa May's performance, when they prevented motions going to the floor about Brexit. Because they knew that most Labour Party members in Britain are pro-Remain, and the party leadership is Eurosceptic, as Jeremy Corbyn has been all his parliamentary career. And Jim mentioned that Theresa May was an unenthusiastic Remain campaigner. Well, so is Jeremy Corbyn. And that's an old enough tradition in the British Labour Party. There were always Eurosceptic trends. We associate Euroscepticism mainly with the Tories. But there was always a Eurosceptic strain in the Labour Party. The policy of the British Labour Party, on which is the potential alternative government, their policy on Brexit is the same as Theresa May's. They want to leave the customs union and they want to leave the single market. And they've made that bluntly clear. There's a man called Keith Starmer, Keir Starmer, I beg your pardon, who is their spokesman or spokesperson on Brexit, who, it seems to me, would like a softer version, but he doesn't seem to be completely in tune with Corbyn and the party leadership. So the situation in Britain, and I agree with the thrust of what Jim was saying, I've been watching British politics, which I fool myself that I understand. I think I've begun to have to concede that I didn't understand it as well as I thought. I've been watching it at close quarters for a long, long time. I cannot remember a time when the front bench personnel in the two main parties were as unimpressive as they are now. And if you look back at the Labour Party, say, back in the 70s and 80s, people like Wilson and Callaghan and their various colleagues, these were heavyweight politicians. Roy Jenkins and all those people. I do not believe, to come back to one of Richard's targets in his comments, I don't believe Margaret Thatcher would have backed the country into the bloody corner that they've been backed into now. I don't believe Harold Wilson or Jim Callaghan would have, or Blair, or John Major. There has been a complete absence of statesmanship in the leadership in Britain in the last years. And I'm very sorry to see that.
The unfair thing about this is that it impacts us deeply. And you know this in Louth.
Yes, of course.
How serious
much.
This is.
Yes, and I just want to say that, like, in the past, obviously, people like Blair and Major as Prime Ministers were very good as regards understanding the Irish issues and Northern Ireland. And what's hugely important for us is whatever party is in power in the UK, it happens to be the Tories, is that they have stability in their government, in their approach to the problems of Northern Ireland, and indeed that we work as closely as possible with them in terms of both of our economies. And I think the key issue here obviously the damage Brexit is doing to the United Kingdom and their economy, yeah. and potentially what it can do to us.
Corbyn has excellent politics on the North
First. I just want to make this point that what's hugely important is that there is stability there. And I would say that all the ingredients for instability are clearly there. And I don't like that. And I don't know what the outcome will be. But our future is working as closely as possible, whatever British government is there, particularly in terms of the North and our Brexit negotiations and our relationship with Britain was never more important than it is now. Mm. Notwithstanding the fact that we've no administration in the North to deal with them.
Yeah, it's hugely serious for our country. A Brexit strategy when they're in such a mess.
Sure, they don't know what they want themselves. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But can I say, Corbyn's politics on the North are very, very good. He has a long familiarity with the North.
And I think he supported the other way.
He got in trouble during the campaign.
But the point is, a Corbyn government would want a good deal for Ireland, right? And to be honest, I think, setting aside the politicking, which is coming both from the British establishment and from Europe on Brexit, they're both playing political games. It doesn't make any real sense to have tariff barriers or hard borders north or south of this island or east and west.
But Richard, you're in favour of Brexit.
I'm in favour of a left exit from the European Union. A left exit is, for example, what the Greeks would have done, faced with austerity, right, is to tell Europe, sorry, lads, we're not going to swallow up this level of austerity in order to bail out Europe's financial institutions. But absolutely to resist and go in the opposite direction from the nasty right-wing nationalism and racism.
But it's impossible to put that spin on Brexit now because that's not what was voted for. I don't agree
at all. And in fact, I really think people should look at what's happening in the rest of the Europe because it's getting scary.
It's getting stronger.
In Germany, we've had fascists, out and out fascists, elected into the parliament. And this is in the heart of the European Union, the bulwark of the European Union. We have the fascist far right entering in the parliament and they are growing all across Europe. And this is scary stuff. And that is a result of austerity.
The defeat of Le Pen was very significant in European politics. Okay. Absolutely.
They still got a scary amount of votes.
No, but it means that Europe is on a new course now and the right has been defeated.
We're taking a break. Jim, you're leaving us now, is that right?
I am, Claire, if that's okay. I'm allowed to go.
Yeah.
He's got a match to go to. The rest of us will still be here after this break. Now, RTÉ's Philip Boucher-Hayes has been at the funeral of former Taoiseach Liam Cosgrave. The funeral mass was in the Church of the Annunciation in Rathfarnham in Dublin at noon today, and he's being buried in Golden Bridge Cemetery in Inchicore. Philip, his son addressed the congregation. What did he have to say?
That's right. The service ended about 25 minutes ago, Claire, and it was unanticipated that any member of the family would address the congregation. But Liam T. Cosgrave, Liam Jr., did thank everybody who had attended for their support and said that Dad was not a fan of eulogies and he wasn't going to do anything to upset him or indeed anybody in the congregation by giving a eulogy. But he thanked all of the people who had looked after him in recent months and said that his father was a man who gave them affection, love, kindness and loyalty and gave it to them in abundance, and that they were all in the family. Himself, his sister Mary and brother Kieran were glad that they'd had him for so long, but nonetheless were going to miss him and may he rest in peace.
And we heard in your earlier report about the number of people who attended. It was a very crowded funeral. Some people didn't get into the church.
Yes, very small church, barely enough room for all of the family and the dignitaries, members of the diplomatic corps who attended, and quite a lot of people left outside. A number of senior council. Sinn Féin's Sean Crowe was there, couldn't get in, and a number of other politicians as well. So it was, though, in keeping, I think, with how the family had wanted this to be, a very small, low-key family affair. Some of the trappings of a state funeral, but not really all the ones that we have come to expect in recent years. For instance, the coffin was brought out of the church by members of the family as opposed to the bearer party who had brought it there. So that's officially the state stepping back, as it were, the military stepping back and allowing the family to bury their father. But there will again be a military presence at Golden Bridge Cemetery. There will be a volley of shots fired over the grave and military escort in. But again, the public are excluded from that, as are the media. It's a very much low-key, small family affair.
And the cortege is on its way now, is it, to Inchicore?
Yes, it is. I was trying to get there ahead of it and I had to pull in, stop to talk to you. It's not there. It'll be there in the course of the next few minutes.
OK, Philip Badger-Hayes, thank you very much for that reporting on the funeral of former Taoiseach Liam Cosgrave. And Fergus, to come to you on this, I suppose it's saying goodbye to a different era in politics.
It is indeed. And both Liam and his father, W.T., gave great service to the state. And Liam was a great Taoiseach, very difficult economic times. He had very difficult troubled times in our country with violence in our streets. British ambassador unfortunately murdered, soldiers being shot on Gardaí. He stood firm against terrorism, and that I think is something I remember from those times very much.
OK, and Richard Boyd Barrett, your constituency, of course. I thought you'd be interested in that fact that we heard earlier on today, that his father's funeral was a state funeral and he, when he heard what it cost, paid up himself.
Yeah, and fair play to him, to be honest. I mean, I've got to be honest and say the political legacy is not one I would share.
Yep.
And I think the sort of conservative, quite right-wing vision of Ireland that he would have held and to a certain extent left us with is one that I'm glad to leave behind. But obviously on a personal level, this is a day for his family.
He was a man of his time.
OK, we'll leave it there. Colin, do you want to add anything to that?
Not really, except it was mentioned that the mid-70s when Cosgrave was Taoiseach, it was really a terrible time economically. The first oil shock more or less coincided with the arrival in office of that government, and they struggled with the economic policy all the way through, plus the explosion of terrorism from Northern Ireland.
OK, we'll leave that there. Thank you all very much indeed for joining us. Fergus O'Dowd, Colin McCarthy, Richard Boyd Barrett and Sinead O'Carroll. We're finishing a little early today to hand over to Saturday Sport as Leinster host Munster in today's Guinness Pro 14 clash at the Aviva Stadium. So do enjoy that. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy the rest of the weekend.
Saturday with Clare Byrne was produced by Anne Farrell. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan. Research was by Leslie Anderson and Sheila Neveal was on sound.